they focus, if they're talking about, for instance, you know, on trying to lead change, they're focused on strategy and on a whole lot of tangible and concrete things, and they forget that their own behaviour and what they're modelling in their own behaviour is the first place they should be looking.
And that was the inimitable Bruce Dixon, waxing philosophic about culture change on the 24th episode of the Modern Learners Podcast. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Will Richardson, your host, and in this episode, Bruce and I are talking culture and looking specifically at an article about Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella and trying to equate some of the efforts that he's made to change culture at Microsoft to the efforts that school leaders can make to bring their own cultures to a different place and perhaps into a more modern place as well. Really want to thank you for joining us for this podcast. If you haven't ranked us or rated us on iTunes, we would love it if you gave us a review there. I think we've got 3 5-star ratings. A few more would certainly help. Don't forget you can find us at modernlearners.com, at change.school, at our Facebook Modern Learners group, and in the next week or two, I think I've been hinting at this before, but we're going to have another big announcement for another way that you can engage in this conversation with us as we keep trying to find different ways of building a movement around reimagination in education in schools. But for now, sit back and relax and enjoy this 40-minute or so conversation between Bruce and me around culture in school. Thanks again for listening.
So, Will, here we are. It's my turn to be the traveler this time. Last week, you were running away from a hurricane, and this time I'm over the other side of my own country, over in Perth in Australia.
Visiting the grandbaby, which is a wonderful thing.
That's exactly what's happening, mate. I am visiting the grandbaby.
And you're tired out and ready to go home, right?
That's fantastic fun. That's great to be over here.
And so it's interesting because, you know, you mentioned I was trying to get out of the way of a hurricane last week. So actually, this new hurricane, Maria, is going to hit right where I was in Puerto Rico.
Wow.
And it's going to hit really badly. It looks like it's going to be a Category 5. And, you know, again, having spent 10 days in that part of the island, this is not going to be good. It's going to be a very, very sad event, I have a feeling. And my heart just goes out to those people. I mean, I keep thinking, you know, what it would be like to be there right now. And, you know, thankfully I'm not, but I feel just horrible for what's about to happen to that island because it looks really, really bad right now.
It's funny, isn't it, how these events can impact on your view of the world and where you're looking and what you're looking at. So, for instance, you know, there was a lot of comment about, you know, there's been a natural disaster in India, which hasn't as much prominent news. There's also a lot of focus has been on Florida and not a lot on Puerto Rico.
Right.
And yet I found it an opportunity to find out a lot about Puerto Rico, and wasn't a lot of happy news happening there either from an economic state.
No, it's not in great shape economically. And I'm just going to tell you, I'll share this quick story, which is why it's kind of painful right now. One of the days that we were down there, we were driving to this beautiful waterfall, and we were on these really windy back roads. And I came around a turn, and there was an old woman who was like standing in the middle of the road, and it was just starting to rain a little bit. And she basically just flagged the car down, and she looked like she was probably about 85, 90 years old. She looked like she was like blind in one eye. She had all these shopping bags and everything. And she just flagged us down, and she started speaking in Spanish. She was saying farmacia and Banco Popular. I'm kind of going, okay. So my daughter Tess, who had been living in Mexico City for the last 6 months, knows enough Spanish to figure out that she just wanted a ride down to the pharmacy, which was supposedly at the bottom of this road, right?
Yep.
So one thing led to another. It started just pouring rain. And so she basically directed us to this waterfall place where she knew the owners. She goes, it's okay. They know who I am. And the funny thing was she was kind of speaking in English and Spanish. And so anyway, long story short, we came into this parking lot for the waterfall, and we came over the crest of this very steep hill And then, you know, as soon as we got over there, it was just filled. It was just packed with people. And now they were running for cover because it was just dumping. And she goes, that's a lot of cars. and that kind of became this little thing that we said the rest of the trip, you know, that's a lot of pizza or whatever. But I keep thinking of her. Because I know this is just not going to end well for her.
Nah.
She lives in this little, very tiny home with a tin roof, you know, and I just keep thinking about the people that we met down there. And that's what makes it powerful, obviously, when you begin to really be there and know the people who are being affected by it. So anyway, not to start this session off on a depressing note, but
the other point, just to flip on, sorry, another spin on this, of course, because we're often saying, you know, how do people, you know, how, what do you discuss with your kids at various ages in schools? And fairly obviously the topic that is, you know, raised around this time is the one around climate change. And on one side, sure, you can take the initiative that, you know, your great leader has taken in this respect. But for us in Australia, it's ridiculously topical because we have huge power issues in Australia. Now, I think I mentioned it last podcast how absurd that is, but it all relates together. I mean, it does remind us we're on one big planet and we better start thinking about it.
Yeah. And it's just a tough stretch right now for a lot of those folks.
Yep.
So what you been doing? Not sure what the great segue is. Remember last week, if you remember, the segue was really, really great. But so, I think we wanted to talk a little bit about culture and leadership today. And I think one of the things I think you'd agree too, we started, this is kind of our name dropper for Change School 3. But I tell you, we just finished up our sixth coaching session this morning.
Mind-boggling.
They've been just mind-bogglingly great. Yep. I mean, really powerful stuff. And this whole idea of culture has come up over and over and over again in these conversations. Yep. And I thought it would be interesting for us to talk a little bit about this Fast Company piece that came out yesterday.
Yep.
That profiles Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella and the way that he has attempted to really change the culture of Microsoft. Obviously, when Steve Ballmer left, it was not a great culture. They were having a lot of issues, and a lot of people actually, when Nadella was chosen, were a little surprised by that selection and wondered if he could really do. And, you know, kind of turn it around, but he has. He's done an amazing job actually in the last 4 or 5 years to do that. And I thought we could maybe talk a little bit about some of the quotes from that article, but also just his general kind of sense of culture. And the one word that comes to mind whenever I read anything about him is the word learning, without question. He is absolutely trying to create a culture of learning in Microsoft. And I know, you know, you spent a lot of time working with Microsoft over the years. I wonder if you have any kind of reflections or insights as to kind of what that shift has looked like and what it was and what it is and how that kind of fits for school leaders as well.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the article, Will, and I think it's a really good article to reflect on for a number of reasons. One is the prominence of Microsoft. Two, I think, is the culture that dominated the company for so many years under Gates and Ballmer. But three is, I think it really does help us understand that even in a culture that was so incredibly strong through those two leaders, and they were very similar in a lot of ways, they weren't the same, but very similar, it is possible to make a change. It is possible to see a shift. I mean, you're talking 100,000 people world. I think it's more than 120,000.
124,000,
And I've worked with them quite intimately, quite closely. I've met Ballmer a few times and I've met Gates a few times. I haven't met Satya. And I'm not trying to name drop, of course, but I'm just saying I was very much exposed to it. I was fortunate enough to be working in a position where I was an outsider looking in, and the conditions of that I worked with them was very much that I was employed to have, you know, my own mind about what I was doing in the education space, but I was trying to help guide some of their choices and some of the work they did, most notably the work that came out in the early noughties around partners in learning was some of the work that I was most proudest of. But I think that the point about it was the culture that was there under Gates and Ballmer. And I'd have to be fair to Gates. I mean, Gates is running a startup company. And there's a very different culture that's got to be going there. You know, it's like the Bezos sure. culture of, you know, Bezos wants everyone to always believe they're in the startup running Amazon. And, you know, the minute they lose that startup culture, they're going to, you know, they're not going to keep going. So I think you can understand the culture that was there when he was running it. I think the time he handed over to Ballmer, though, the culture was very strongly know-it-all. If you didn't either know it or pretend to know it, or you couldn't give the right answers at the right time, you were dead in the water, literally of, you know, you're fired. Now, there were times I saw some stuff going on that was just, I thought, abominable. Very early in the 90s, let's say, this was before we became incredibly politically correct in a lot of what we do, but it was the culture of the organization. You had to be right. You had to sacrifice yourself for the company. The only thing that mattered was reporting up, and the whole culture of the company was competition. You were ranked, you were evaluated, you were made accountable for what you were doing, and every time it came to your review, your review process, which was in January, I'm trying to remember these times, I would say literally the company closed down for 2 weeks while everyone prepared themselves for this big review process, because they got a ranking and everything in their life was determined on that. And that was all...
Sounds familiar. It kind of sounds familiar. Yeah, what does that echo?
What does that sound like? Exactly. And I frankly, you know, I realized that as long as I felt, just personally, and this is not a personal affront to Steve Ballmer, because on a personal level, I found him, you know, a really decent sort of person. But from a company point of view, it was very hardcore, very, very hardcore, and a lot of ranting. I mean, Steve was renowned for, I saw him on stage, one of their global conferences, and he literally carried on a treat and trying to wind people up, inspire them. But that was the culture. So we're talking about a culture pre-Nadella, and the company's share price, I'm pretty sure at the time that he left, was about $23. And, you know, everyone had written them off. They'd said Microsoft hasn't done the transition well, they haven't transitioned post-Gates well, and that there's not much future for them. As a company, they're not an innovative company anymore. They're dying on the vine, a bit like, you know, some of the other technology companies had. In comes Nadella. And he is such a contrast and so out of the box that people can't even imagine how he'll succeed. But he had one interesting twist to him being appointed. He was an insider. He'd been in the company some, I think, 20 years or something. He was a developer. So here he had a developer mentality, which everyone thought was the worst thing he could do. He was an insider in the company. They thought, oh, no, here we go again. We're going to get a bit more of it. Well, you couldn't get a more contrasting personality.
Right.
And as you said, the thing that comes through from it, and in that article, I think it's a great article, they talk about it's gone from being a know-it-all company to promoting learn-it-all curiosity.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to finish by saying, I think it's week 7 in Change School, I had a quote of his, which I just thought was just so normal, open, and dare I ever use the word for a CEO of Microsoft, so vulnerable. The quote is, "Many who know me say I am also defined by my curiosity and thirst for learning. I buy more books than I can finish. I sign up for more online courses than I can complete. I fundamentally believe that if you are not learning new things, you stop doing great and useful things." You couldn't imagine a more contrasting personality. Yeah.
And let me just say too, you know, we're certainly not talking about Microsoft because we're promoting Microsoft. We think that this culture issue is really, really fascinating. And especially in that it parallels in many ways, I think, the change that's required or maybe needed in terms of school cultures as well. And so I just want to read that that quote, and you kind of referenced it, but he's inspired the company's 124,000 employees to embrace what he calls learn-it-all curiosity, that in turn has inspired developers and customers and investors to engage with the company in new, more modern ways, right? And, you know, in our conversations with school leaders and in the work that we do and just in looking at the schools that we visited, how many of them really could you say or describe a learn-it-all curiosity, right?
Yeah.
Very, very, very few.
Yep.
Most yep. of them, I don't know that I'd describe them as know-it-all cultures, but I certainly wouldn't describe them as learn-it-all curiosity type of cultures. But what's interesting about that line that I just read, what's even more interesting to me is how that type of culture then inspires developers, customers, in our case, students, parents, community members, you know, to engage in the school in more modern ways, which is really what we want. So
yep.
I do think that this culture question at the end of the day is paramount to any change that's going to happen. I'm certainly not the only person that believes that. I mean, Peter Senge talks about this a lot, you know, moving from a teaching culture to a learning culture. Yep. Saracen talks about this a lot. Robert Evans talks about this a lot.
Yep.
But it is interesting to me when someone is able to do that in a big way at a big company, what are the things that we can learn in education from, you know, the types of things that he's doing
yeah.
or that other people yeah. are doing in those situations as well?
And don't you think that so too often people, firstly, they say you can't do it. Then they say, how do you do it? And then they look and they sort of look for some really complicated strategy or whatever. And often it's the little things that make the difference. And I think it says at the top of that article that one of the first things he did when he walked in was he sent a copy of a book, which I haven't read, I'm going to, and there was something fairly topical about
it. It's an old book.
Nonviolent communication. And he sent a copy yeah. of that to all the leadership across Microsoft. Yeah. If that wasn't making a statement, I'll go he for Tiggy. And
Keep going.
But what intrigues me about him doing that was there's a parallel in education that I can quote. Back in the 90s, the Victorian Education Department, which is a system of about 600,000 kids, recruited a new head. I'm not going to mention names. I'll just keep it at a neutral level. And the director who was the deputy director who was appointed, over the 5 years from when he was appointed, his tenure had some difficult years towards the end, which I won't go into. But in the first 5 years, about the same period that Satya's been in Microsoft, he literally flipped the culture of that state system. And once again, I was intimately involved with it. That's, you know, a period of time that I was working with him over in a variety of the schools and with the regions and regional directors. And guess what he did? One of his first things he did when he walked in was he gave a copy of John Bransford's How People Learn to every principal in the state. 1,700 copies, and I was actually working with John, and he was thrilled when he found that out. He then followed it up, and what he then did, of course, that's how old-fashioned is it? A book study? Are you joking?
Yeah,
how on earth can this have any impact? Yeah. And then he followed it up with a book by Art Costa, and everyone used to go, everyone sort of got the book, this is a bit of rubbish, you know. How's he expect? Well, all of a sudden, the regional director, who's equivalent to the superintendent, would ring them up and say, hey, listen, I'm going to come round to set a meeting up between 12 principals in the area. I want to have a talk about that book. And they go, what? You're serious?
Right.
I think it was about 10 books later. He did one every 6 months. 10 books later, they got the drift. This was about learning. This was about understanding new ideas. It was about embracing them. And the cultural shift he made within that department of 600,000 kids was enormous. So It's interesting that it was just a book that both of them gave out to their leadership that
But it really wasn't just a book, right?
No,
because it then became a social interaction around those ideas.
Absolutely.
And I think that that's the important part. We see a lot of schools that are handing out books and doing book study, and I think that's
great. Yeah, sure.
But there has to be that kind of social interaction. I've really come to the conclusion that it's very, very difficult to enact change on your own just because you read a book, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be something that you have, you talk about with someone and you play with those ideas and you figure out how those ideas are most specific to whatever your reality is, whatever school you're in or whatever community you're in. Just another piece of there was another, and by the way, I said that was an old book. That actually, Nonviolent Communication is not that old of a book. Actually, it's about 3 years old. But there's, they have a list of books in that article that Nadella is reading. Some of them are from the 40s, you know, and 50s, which you know, we love those old books.
That's right.
That's right. We love those old books, right? And I can hold up a whole bunch of old books that that we're reading and talking about as well. Another book, though, that he mentions prominently is Growth Mindset by Carol Dweck, which, you know, has gotten a little bit of back and forth in recent years in terms of the research and whatever else. But, I mean, if you take it just for the idea that you have to have a mindset that is a learning mindset. I mean, when I think of growth mindset, that's what I think of, right? It's that I'm willing to learn, I'm willing to engage. And that really has been another factor in changing the culture at Microsoft that they talk a lot about having this kind of learning mindset. And they give a great example, a couple of great examples of really bad failures that have happened under Nadella's tenure and how he has basically, again, culturally embrace those failures as learning opportunities. The one was when they had that bot that was learning to respond to people online, and remember, and all of a sudden people started programming it to be really racist, and all of a sudden the bot became racist, and you know, they had to take it down, and it was just horrible, right? But you know, he had a choice. He could have come in and said, "That's it, you're fired. You know, that's ridiculous." But he came in and he said, "Look, let's learn from this. You know, we know that there's potential here. We know that there's a use for this technology that will help the world, you know, but we need to figure out what it is." And the other is, you know, even on a personal note, when he made a statement about women in the workplace that was probably a little tone deaf and not very sensitive, and he was called out on it. He just wrote a email to the entire company saying, "You know what? Absolutely, that was a really bad thing to say. I take total ownership of that, and we're going to work harder to make sure that we respect diversity and gender and all those types of things." So, again, I wonder the extent to which school leaders are really thinking hard enough about the importance of culture before change, how it's just one of the foundational aspects of what they do, they need to do.
So on that, the other piece in the article is when he talks about what you said, he talks about culture and strategy. And we have a very humorous clip, a graphic, where a young child has a breakfast cereal or something in a bowl, and it says, "Culture eats strategy for breakfast." And that's the point he's making. He believes, as you just said, you can have all the strategy you like in the world, but if you've got the wrong culture, it won't get you to where you want to go. And I could give, you know, a whole lot, I'm not going to, but I give a whole lot of specific examples, you know, of products and whatever else out of Microsoft that suffered as a result of the earlier culture. But you can also see now they have a very different perspective, that they see failure as a growth within the company and the individual, and they're trying to learn and have an open mind about it, to the point that they also talked about their leadership teams having meetings where they get to focus on, they called it the researchers of the amazing. So they reflected on the work that was happening internally and celebrated it. You know, weren't waiting for it to be announced as a new product, because, you know, until it was a product in the prior leadership, it really wasn't worth, you know, any time. So I think it's a brilliant article in that it highlights what can be done, and it's a period of 5 years with 124,000 people. There has been a major cultural
crazy system. Yeah, it's crazy. And I love the fact too that he is that kind of different personality, you know. He's not that bombastic you know, lead by fire, it really, you know, totally inspiring type of person. He's much more kind of sedate and thoughtful and empathetic. And it's a really interesting shift. So let me ask you, Bruce, I mean, if you were to pick out a couple things upon which culture has to be built, in schools. Let's make it specific to schools. I mean, what would you say would be a couple of the foundational building blocks for a culture like that to kind of take root and flourish in a school?
Well, it's the one we're talking about is the most logical, and that is, I think, the one that people forget about. They focus, if they're talking about, for instance, you know, on trying to lead change, they're focused on strategy and on a whole lot of tangible and concrete things, and they forget that their own behaviour and what they're modelling in their own behaviour is the first place they should be looking. And I think we may have talked about in a previous podcast, and I won't necessarily make mention of the person, but we have talked about one of our previous members of the community, a superintendent in a school district, you know, who basically by her own behaviour across the school district set up a model as a learner, it very much in the same mould as Sachin Nadella. She really put herself out there and said to the rest of the community, hey, listen, you know what, I'm going to actually show what I talk about when I want us to be seen as learners. And she put herself in an extraordinary position. And I think that immediately it sends a signal. These are all signals. And I think you've got to have signals, and then you've got to have something that backs that up. You don't want to have signals right. And then run away from it and say, oh, look, wasn't that cute? You know, oh, wow, we had a cutesy name. It was called Researcher of the Amazing. That's hopeless if all you're going to do is come up with a cutesy name like that. But if you're actually serious about it and intentional about why you're doing these things, if he's intentional, as you said about the book, you know, there's book studies all over the place. But you back it up. Why was that book selected? What's the impact that book's going to have within the school? What's the message you're trying to? I mean, you don't need to ask what the message between nonviolent communication was. everyone got that. But you know what a signal he sent out, and then obviously he backed it up. So I think about those signals.
But I think what backs up that signal then is, how clearly have you articulated what you believe about how kids learn, and what are your values? I mean,
sure. Sorry.
I think, you know, you have to be very clear about what you value in terms of the work, and yep. that those beliefs and values are really, I think, what builds culture. And then, as you said, everybody has to act on those. Everybody has to model those. Everyone has to, and that's what you honor, and that's what you display. That's what you make transparent, and that's what you expect. And too often, again, you and I both walk into schools and we can't figure out what the belief system is, you know, what the values are, what the values are that align with beliefs. I mean, many schools we walk into, and you can tell the values right away are getting great AP scores, getting, you know, let's do really well in the standardized test, let's make sure kids graduate and go to college, and all those types of things. And those are values, obviously. Those are things that people value. But then our question is always, well, how do those values align with what you really believe about learning and what you know about learning? And that's, I think, where the tension comes. And that's where there's a very interesting, important conversation that has to take place before people can really begin to shift culture. And again, I think that book study, you know, all that kind of stuff is a way to begin that conversation. But certainly it's not something you can skip over. You can't just all of a sudden, you know, without that.
Why do you think, I mean, we talk about this a lot, and we talk about an awful lot in Change School. And when we talk about it, even before we sort of talked about it as much as we have, it seems so obvious. It seems so obvious to say, why wouldn't you be aligning your practice with what you believe? I can't, at times, I shake my head and think, I find this, it's really disturbing to think that, you know, it doesn't happen very often. You know, what is it?
You know, It's a great question, and it's really complex. I think the easy answer is, you know, Dewey didn't win. If you know what I mean. I think Dewey and Montessori and Malaguzzi and Piaget and all of those folks who I think had some very clear and sound beliefs about learning were unable to beat the efficiency model of education. And I think we've just become so enculturated now in that efficiency model, and that, you know, the goals are all measurable. The outcomes have to be measurable, and you know, we have to create data around it and all that other stuff, that it's very difficult to kind of step back from that and say, well, what we really value is the stuff that's not measurable. You know, what we really value is curiosity and creativity and problem solving and all that kind of stuff. So it is, you know, and we talk about this all the time. It's common sense, but it's very difficult to act on that common sense.
Yeah. You know,
it's like if you're driving a car, it's common sense not to drive on the wrong side of the road, right? And so you get over to the right side of the road. But in schools, it's just much more difficult to stay on the, you know, kind of the path that you know is the path that's required for kids to really flourish as learners. I don't know. It is interesting, though.
It is. But it does give us rise to a slight segue to another article I know we both read in the last short while. And that was one of those constraints, one of those spaces that we hang on to, and that's grades. You know, this whole notion of grading. And maybe you want to just reflect a little bit on the actual article.
Well, yeah. So the Post article was pretty interesting in that it was talking about a school district that had gone to P for proficient and whatever the other letters are, you know, instead of the A, B, C, D type of thing.
Yep, yep.
And that basically after a couple of years, they decided to go back to A, B, C, D. And because it was too vague for parents.
Yep.
Okay.
And that's not what they had when they were at school.
I think that no one's going to argue real vociferously against the research that says that grades are a horrible motivator for learning, that they, in many ways, and we've been having conversations about this, about kids like literally depressed and crying in the hallway because they are into this, you know, whole ABC ranking sorting thing, that decisions are made about classes because kids want to be valedictorian, not because they want to learn anything.
Yep.
So I don't think anybody really argues that, right? But what I love this, what I don't love, right, is the president of the PTA said, I'm glad that it went back to the ABCD thing. I grew up with an ABCD system, and I think probably most of the teachers did. It makes it an easier process to communicate. Which again goes back to really what they're saying is, I don't really care what's better for kids. It's just easier to communicate A, B, C, D.
That's right.
So let's just get all this angst, you know, out of our conversations around grades, and let's just keep doing what we've been doing, which is totally, totally just bad for kids. So, I don't even know what to say about those types of articles because go ahead.
Do you think it's an absolute, it's an extreme case of trying to do the wrong thing right? That we've got, we ABC'd it and we put numbers out of 100 into it. So let's just change the letters and we'll make them proficient or extremely, excessively good or whatever the labels are. When, what's the point? I mean, the point is, you know, not just what you know, but what you can do with what you know. So why don't we give kids an opportunity to show what they know through performance, through exhibition, through, you know, that's the problem. We're trying to continue a practice that we've had for more than 100 years, and all we're doing is changing the letters we put there.
And we're not changing the culture, which goes back to what we were talking about before.
Totally.
The failure here is that this district did not build the capacity of parents to understand why.
Totally. 100%.
Why to make the change.
Yep.
And then they did a pretty horrible job of helping parents understand what the change was.
Yep.
Because you read some of the stuff in this article and, you know, I mean, I guess ES was exceptional and, you know, parents were saying it was like an ES was an elusive bird or a unicorn. They existed, but you never saw one, right? So let's, instead of exceptional, let's just give A's to everybody.
Yeah.
You know, because you know what I'm saying, right? So but it does go back again to the whole idea of change in a vacuum.
Yeah.
That, you know, we want to do these things on the edges, but we're not grounding that change in a deeper belief system, value system that says to parents, the reason we are doing this is because we understand that grades are not great motivators. They are unhealthy for kids to be, it's unhealthy for kids to compete at this level.
Yep.
That basically the world has changed in such a way that grades do not now reflect
yep.
what people want to know about your child. And yep. that, yeah, that's different from the way that you experience school, but we're the learning experts in this community. And so we are making this change because we think it benefits your child. And, you know, it's too bad that there's not, and this is me talking now, but it's too bad that there's not enough trust within the community to say to the school, okay, we trust you to make the right decision about our kids yep. when it comes to this stuff. And so, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I really like that, the way you phrased that. Change in a vacuum, I think, is a really interesting way of thinking about it, because that is exactly what this is. And that is, very sadly, so much of what we see in schools is exactly that. It's not grounded in a reality about our beliefs around learning. It's not grounded in the reality of the context in which our schools are now situated, our kids are growing up in. And so we're tweaking, as we said, trying to do the wrong thing righter. And we just continually misinform, mislead, and build mistrust across a community.
That's right.
And that doesn't help anyone.
No, it doesn't. And it, you know, by going through a process like this school district, do you think that's raised the idea of professionalism among the educators running the place?
That's right.
I mean, you know what I mean? And so just like Nadella handed out nonviolent communication to all of his leaders, I mean, yep. this school should have rolled out book study on any Alfie yep. Cone book that you want.
That's right.
And, totally. And just said, or point. Article yeah. or whatever else, and yep. sat down and said, look, let's talk about this. You know, yep. let's understand what it is that we're doing, why yep. we're doing it. Yep. You know what I mean? So it's frustrating. These types of articles, as you can tell.
Yeah, I agree.
just really frustrating because there are people who are trying to do the right thing here and yep. make the experience of schools better, but they are falling back. And this is what Papert talked a lot about too, you know, that schools have this autoimmune response to change, right?
Yep.
That
yep.
the system, the organism wants to bring everything back yep. to the way it
yep.
was.
Yep.
But it's because we just don't, we're just not, I don't know what the word is, patient enough. We're not willing enough. We're not motivated enough to get into the weeds and to change at the foundational level. The types of conversations that are happening. It's just much easier to say, oh, we're going to try this or we're going to do this. And 99 times out of 100, that just trying something doesn't work.
But surely the thing that I think you and I are finding the most exhilarating is the word I can think of and inspiring about the conversations that we've been having in Change School. And yes, we are just going to make mention of that topic again. But I've got to tell you, the six.
This isn't a commercial. It's really not a commercial. It is informing our work and our thinking. So it's like we can't separate it out. But anyway, go ahead.
And the conversations that we've had there have really taught us. You know, we're learning so much from the leaders that we're having these conversations with. And the point about this is that the core of this isn't rocket science. You don't need to study 45 steps on what to do on, you know, as I said, you know, just to make it as complicated, straightforward. It takes a lot of work. It takes enormous commitment. And it takes, above all, belief in the process. But for everyone that comes and gets involved with this, when we're talking to them, we don't get pushback. No one says, oh, no, I don't want to. Why would I want to start with beliefs around learning? No, I want to start with teaching. No one said, what have we had? A couple of hundred people, not one person's ever said that to us. It's crazy. Yeah. Yeah. You know, so we're just going on a pretty simple journey that I think everyone enjoys taking with other people, sharing their ideas, their experiences, their insights with their peers in other places. And along the way, I think undoing a lot of the wrong that's been done in the past and laying out a journey that will bring about sustainable, substantial change for their modern learners.
And I think the message is, as we kind of finish this up, but, you know, I think the message is that it's really, really hard, but it is doable.
Yep.
You know, I think if someone can come in and change the culture of Microsoft, as you suggest, 124,000 people who
yep.
Have millions and millions of people who are their customers and their constituencies and everything else. if someone can come in and do that, then I think it's eminently possible to change culture within schools. I don't think anyone disagrees with that, but yep. it is really, really hard on lots of different levels. Part of it is, to be honest, the attributes of leadership that you need to have certain characteristics as a leader that just work. And to, let's be honest, I mean, they're not prevalent in education. Most educational leaders are managers, they're not, you know, kind of those inspirational risk takers that as Robert Evans calls, builds a followership, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
So that's a part of it, but also, like I said, it takes time. It takes intentionality. It takes consistency. It takes a lot of capacity building. It takes all sorts of stuff that most people, especially if you're a superintendent, and we've said this before, but you know, when average lifetime of a superintendent tenure in the States right now is about 2.5 years. I mean, it's almost forget it. You know, it's like, why even bother? Yep. So anyway, but that doesn't mean that it's still not worth pursuing. And that it's not really, really good, important work to do for the kids that we serve. So, yeah, interesting conversation.
Very cool, mate. Yep. Well, it's been good talking to you.
Yeah, as always, safe travels back. Give the grand boy a hug, and we'll talk next week.
Cheers,
all right.
Mate.
Thanks, okay. Bruce. Cheers.
Thanks, Ben.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
So thanks again for listening, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that episode. And Bruce and I will be back again next week, barring any weather events, to bring you another episode of the Modern Learners Podcast. Don't forget, you can engage with us on our blog using our SpeakPipe app. You can join our Modern Learners Facebook group. You can find us at change.school and on Twitter and all over the place. We are always interested in the conversations that you are having and the ways in which we can push your thinking and push your bar a little bit higher when it comes to how we begin to reimagine schools for the modern world. So have a great week, everyone. Thanks again for listening, and hopefully you'll join us again next week.